I'm Farron Peterson, here today with Hall of Fame jockey Steve Cawthon at Keeneland Racecourse. Thank you to Keeneland for letting us use the Lafayette Room. Steve was a Sports Illustrated Sportsman of the Year in 1977. He is in both the United States Horse Racing Hall of Fame and the British Racing Hall of Fame. He is the only jockey to have won both the Kentucky Derby and the Epsom Derby, which is Europe's equivalent of the Kentucky Derby. He's won two Triple Crowns, the United States Triple Crown and the England Fillies Triple Crown. And he has many other accolades, but we will stop there.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Boundless Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Farron Peterson, a professional jockey and veterinarian in Lexington, Kentucky. We are here to learn from stories of resilience, risk-taking, and perseverance. Steve, I know your father, Tex Cawthon, taught you to ride, although he was not a jockey himself. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, my dad was from Southwest Texas. He was born in a town called Muleshoe, which was, I think there was about 100 people that lived there. And he was raised in Sweetwater, and so he was, you know, he was the old West, you know, kind of, you know, small farm and raised on a farm. And, you know, he broke horses when he was 12 and 13 at some farm down in Texas, and then went to the racetrack when he was pretty young, like 16 or so, and eventually became a blacksmith. So he wanted to be a jockey, but he was obviously always going to be too big. So, when I came to him at 12 years old and said, I want to be a jockey, you know, he said, well, you know, I'll do everything I can to help you. He said, but, you know, and what I can't help you with, I'll try to get somebody that I, you know, believe knows what they're doing and they'll teach you. But, you know, he was a great horseman. He was an all-around horseman, and he loved, you know, the game. And so I think he was thrilled when he heard that I wanted to be a jockey. My mom was not so much, you know. She was a little less inspired by my choice. But, you know, me and my dad were really close. And thankfully, you know, he was, you know, kind of my right-hand guy when, as I was proceeding to try to learn to be, you know, to ride, you know, race horses. And just kind of, you know, made me a better horseman all around, really.
And your dad is in the Hall of Fame, correct?
And my dad's in the Horseshoeing Hall of Fame, yeah, exactly. So,
and then he raised you around horses? You learned all the grunt work and
yeah, I mean, I was mucking out stalls when I was five. So, I, you know, had to start, you know, well, once I started school, I had to go clean them before I went to school or after when I got back. So I usually tried to do it before because I wanted to play when I got done, you know, because uh-huh. My buddies would come around, we'd play basketball. But, yeah, it was, you know, it was a great childhood. I showed 4-H, you know. I showed Western, but and really, you know, to be quite honest, I was small, but I was very strong, and I was I always kind of thought of myself as being a football player, you know, because I love football. I like, you know, I like the contact of it and all that, mm-hmm. And I was pretty fast, and I was a big Johnny Unitas fan, so I thought, you know, someday, you know, maybe I'll be a, you know, I could, you know, of course I didn't realize I wasn't going to keep growing. I played on the seventh grade Pee Wee Football League, and after that year of, you know, running for my life and nearly getting killed by these huge guys. I decided it was time to think of something else. And then I read the book Eddie Arcaro had written, I Ride to Win, and it was like just twigged something in my brain that, this is, I know what I want to do now. And so from that point on, at the age of 12, I was pursuing, you know, becoming a jockey.
And your dad
lucky enough to be or had been around it. So I was, you know, in a good situation to move forward. My dad was willing to help me, yeah.
Mm-hmm. He'd get you on hay bales with a saddle and teach you. And
yeah, I can't remember who, that might have been my idea just because I wanted to practice, but, you know, I'd get two or three hay bales stacked up and I'd tie some reins to the, you know, the
hay bale in front.
The wood, whatever. We had some, like, you know, crossbar things and, you know, and I'd just be riding away and trying to hit in the same, you know, make sure I was hitting the horse in the same spot, you know, obviously not in the flank, you know, like where it would be their hip and just kind of learning rhythm and, you know, just, as you know, as a young person, you can imagine Yeah, as far as I was concerned, I was in a race. You know, I was head and head with Cordero down the stretch.
They move still as a team to the back stretch. Seattle slow along the rail, affirmed on the outside.
It's a really cool thing to, you know, to have all that there for me to where I could do that. And being the kind of focused individual I was, that's what I did. You know, I mean, when I had spare time, you know, from that point on, most guys would be out playing basketball or whatever after school. I'd be up in the rafters, you know, working on my, you know, my stick, you know, action. And, you know, obviously two summers I broke horses at a local farm, which was a great experience. They taught me a lot more than I taught them, but it was, you know, I really learned how to think like a horse, you know, try to encourage a horse to want to do what I wanted him to do instead of trying to make him do what I wanted him to do. And, you know, really that's kind of been how I've always tried to do it. It just seems like it's a lot easier if you can entice somebody to, this is a great idea.
Cooperate with
or
you.
Think it's their idea. What the heck?
I don't care. Make it their idea.
Make it their idea, but just, you know, get them to somehow figure out that it's not bad to do this. You know, we can do this.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd always really liked how your dad taught you, even though he wasn't a jockey, because my dad taught me to pole vault, and he was never a pole vaulter.
All right.
But he did track, and he did triple jump, and he always admired the pole vaulters. So same thing. He thought, I'm going to make my daughters pole vaulters, and coached me. And he was a great coach without having done it himself.
I mean, that I can say is, you know, like you said, it's always good to have somebody in your corner like that, that you know whatever you know, whatever you're trying to do, they're going to figure out a way to help you do it.
Mm-hmm.
It was, yeah.
Who was your role model early on as a jockey?
Probably Braulio Baeza.
But jockey Braulio Baeza urging him on. At the top of the stretch, Baeza calls for a burst of speed, and he gets it.
Because he was a tall guy, and I was kind of, you know, even though I was only 5'1" at the time, I was tall.
You're so tall.
I was skinny, but, you know, I could see myself, you know, I envisioned myself eventually being something more like him and kind of, you know, like sitting straight up in the saddle, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously his low, still, the way he was on the horse, you know, he stayed still and was low and, you know, kept his back, you know, really good and straight. And he was, you know, wind, because my dad was all about wind resistance, you know.
Mm-hmm, the aerodynamics.
Aerodynamics of it all. And so, yeah, it was, that was probably, you know, who I first, but, you know, then as you go along, you, I mean, of course, I was lucky enough to ride with some of the greatest riders that ever lived and Cordero and you know, Turcotte and Velasquez and Pinkai and Shoemaker, you know, I watched them all and, you know, you pick up what you can, what you think you can use and, and stuff, some things they could do didn't really work for me. And so, okay, I, you know, didn't try to, you know, do everything they did. I just tried to do things that made sense to me that worked for me.
So. Mm-hmm. Chris
McCarron. I did that all my whole career, you know, in Europe as well, you know.
Always learning from others.
Yeah.
Yeah, Chris McCarron has also told me about Braulio's style. And he said when you'd be next to him in a race, you couldn't tell when he was going to ask his horse to go. Which, you know, you're watching your competition thinking, when are they going? He'd just be so still.
Right.
And they couldn't see him give that cue.
I kind of did that to Georgie down the backside on the firm in the Belmont.
You made a move early?
No, I didn't. I was like, you know, I was making him wait to figure out when I was going to make my move, you know. But, because, yeah, I think, you know, it's like, well, you know, I knew he didn't really want to go. So it's like, you know, and then that's why we ended up going half or six furlongs in 1:14, you know, in the Belmont.
Mm-hmm.
Three quarters, however, went in 1:14. The pace is still slow.
So I must have learned that from Braulio.
Okay.
Without realizing it.
Yeah. How old were you when you rode your first race?
I was 16 and 12 days.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Was the cutoff 16? So you had
back
to wait.
Then it was 16. I don't know what it is. Is it?
It might be 18 now.
Is it now 18? But anyway, back then you could get your license when you were 16. And when I was 16, I looked like I was 10.
Mm-hmm.
16-year-old apprentice who looks like his biggest concern should be a date for the junior prom, not riding million-dollar horses in big races.
So I went to the jockeys, you know, to get my try to get my license because you had this sit in front of the state steward who was Keen Dangerfield back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, my dad was with me and we went into the room to talk to him and he looked over at me and he kind of said, you know, For quite right, you look a little young. I think he thought maybe I was trying to, you know, like some guys
forge your ID.
Forge your ID or whatever. But
did your dad make this?
But anyway. So he wouldn't let me have my jockey's license that day, and I was obviously sick, you know, sick to death, you know, that I was like, oh my God, you know, they're going to not let me ride. And, but anyway, luckily, cause I'd been around and I'd actually been illegally, you know, riding at River Downs, and backside the guys at the gate and different people said, you know, oh, the key, he's fine. He can ride, you know, he's safe and, you know, all that stuff. And so when I went back a week later, he gave me my license. So I went in on my birthday, you know, or day after. And then a week later, he gave me my license. And then like 4 or 5 days later, I got to ride my first race on King of Swat, who finished dead last or second last. I can't remember. But, you know, he at least had enough speed to get me in the race. And I got the feel of it all, the excitement of kind of being in the hunt. And, you know, until he got tired and then, you know, we... back door, but it was at least it was a start, and it, you know, it was great. Then I rode about 4 or 5 more races. But my first race was at Churchill, and I rode 4 or 5 more races on horses that, you know, really had no chance. They were all 30-1 or 40-1 or 80-1, whatever. You know,
I know,
and they finished mid pack. Yeah, right. And so finally, my uncle gave me a call, and he said, "I've got a horse running at River Downs that, you know, I think he's got a shot if you want to come riding." I said, "I'll be there." And that was my first winter red pipe. And then I rode a winner for my mom the next day on a filly called Mary McCullough. And I rode a, and you know, this is my only mount each day. And next day I won a race for a trainer called Dean Loring. And then from that point on, I was getting offered 5 rides in every race, you know. I had the bug. I was, you know, they're getting the bug, and
yeah, getting away.
I can actually guide a horse. You know, they knew I could ride well enough to get them around, you know, without. So, and then.
And was this mostly at River Downs?
This was all at River Downs, and like within 2 months, I won 120 races.
Wow.
And then I went to Chicago for a couple 3 months, I guess. I rode at Arlington and then Hawthorne briefly, and then came back for the fall meet at Churchill. And that's where I was riding with Eddie Delahousie and Don Brumfield. And at the end of that meet, I was trying to figure out where I was going to go. If I was going to go to Florida, which sounded nice. You know,
nice and warm.
Or go to New York, which is cold. And but, you know, but I, you know, in my mind always, New York was, you know, back then it was like, this is
where you want to be with the top jockeys.
Right. Top jockeys and top horses, you know. Yeah, obviously the ones, they filter down there for a little bit in the winter, but then the rest of the time they're in New York. So, and those guys said, you know, this is a good time to break into New York because, you know, all these guys are going to go south. You know? Well, the winter I went up there, Cordero, Turcott, Velasquez, they all stayed up there.
Nice.
You know, for whatever reason. I mean, they weren't riding, you know, they were taking, you know, they were taking mounts that they wanted, but.
You got the leftover mounts.
Once I got going, I was getting plenty of good mounts. It wasn't that. But same deal. I mean, I went in and I won my first race beating Cordero Neck in the allowance, you know, the allowance of the day.
That'll catch their attention.
And the next day I won a race on a horse. I can't remember the name of the horse, but it was a, you know, and then the third day I went on like 100-1 or, you know, 90-1 shot. And so then, yeah, bingo. I was, you know, same deal. I was back, you know, getting offered a lot of mounts because I still had the 5-pound bug. And that's pretty much all winter. I was, you know, doing that and riding against, you know, guys that I was learning a lot from every, you know, every day. So it was cool.
And after riders lose their bug or weight allowance, which lasts a year, they often lose their momentum. Yet you got a Triple Crown mount. How did that happen?
Well, I, you know, the weird thing is that year I won 487 races and I was actually off for a month. So I probably could have, you know, given the record a little bit of a competition if I'd have been able to go. But I had, and it was the opening day at Belmont, and that's when I had my first really bad fall. And I was, you know, they told me I would be out for 3 months. Well, a month from the day that I fell, I was back riding my first race. And I won my...
What was your injury?
Well, I broke my arm. I broke these two knuckles. Got crushed.
Mm-hmm.
A horse stepped on my foot or my hand there and severed the tendons in the back of my hand.
Mm-hmm.
I broke my arm, my ribs, and my collarbone.
Okay.
And I had about 50 stitches in my eyebrow from where the helmet had come down and cut into my head. But, you know, like when you're young, you can heal quicker, you know. And you know, if I'd have done that now, I'd, you know, be out for 10 years. But but back then, when you're young and you're hungry and you, you know, want to, your desire to get back. So, you know, I rode back. And the first horse I rode back was a horse for Laz Barrera called Little Miracle.
Mm-hmm.
And it happened, that Little Miracle happened to be a half brother to Affirmed.
Oh, wow.
Weird. You know, he's by a horse called Little Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
I don't, yeah, the dam won't tell you was a claimer, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But somewhere along the line, Mr. Wilson had bought him and bred him to his stallion, and Affirmed arrived. And, but anyway, I'd ridden Little Miracle for Laz, and so I'd really, the first time I'd really ridden for him.
Mm-hmm.
And started our, you know, kind of situation where, you know, I was in, at some point, while I'd been hurt, Affirmed had run a guy called Gonzalez, an apprentice, had ridden him first time out. Then second time out, he ran in a stake and Cordero won on him. And then he ran in another stake at Belmont. And that was when Aladar beat him and he was second. And then they sent Affirmed to California and Lafitte rode him and he won the Hollywood Futurity. Back then it was, you know, they changed the races all the time, but back then it was, you know, just a 2-year-old, you know, 6-furlong stake race. He won by 8. So those guys both had the mount ahead of me,
mm-hmm.
but we got up to New York, to Belmont or to Saratoga, and he was going to run in the Sanford, and, I'm sure, you know, he was offered to Cordero, and Cordero thought he had a better horse called Tilt Up that Leroy Jolly had. And so he said, I'm riding Tilt Up. And then I'm sure they also asked Lafitte, but he didn't want to. I mean, back then the Sanford was a $45,000 stake.
Okay.
And, you know, coming from California to, you know, get to Saratoga is not easy. You know, it's a lot of... So he obviously he decided
passed it up.
So none of them really knew how good the firm was. I don't think anybody did, you know. They knew he was a nice little horse, but you know, not a Triple Crown
mm-hmm.
potential horse or a Derby horse or any of that. So anyway, I got the mount and I rode him and I won on him. And the first time I won on him, you know, I knew he was a nice horse, but again, I wasn't, you know, like thinking, oh, this is the best thing I've ever seen or sat on. Then whatever it was, 3 or 4 weeks later, when he ran in the Hopeful against Aladar, that was the day I knew I found
this was this the whole
special horse, you know, because we in the Hopeful, they hooked up at the head of the lane and it was like two rocket ships taking off.
They're moving up on the outside with Aladar approaching the 16th pole. Affirmed and Aladar. Affirmed along the inside. Aladar on the outside at the wire. It's Affirmed in front.
What a feeling.
It really was a great feeling. You know, just, you know, they left there. And, you know, there was other good horses in the race. I think Believe It was kind of like always the third, you know, third best horse.
Mm-hmm.
He was always
poor Believe It.
In the dirt.
Born in the wrong year.
In the Preakness, you know.
Uh-huh.
He was, I think he was third in the Hopeful that year, maybe, as a 2-year-old. And so, there was a lot of good horses around. And but these two, like, you know, they were just that much better.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the start of, you know, well, I mean, the rivalry kind of started. But that was when people really realized this is a serious rivalry.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, no, it was a great, great thing to be involved with.
Yeah. And at 18, to be going through the Triple Crown, were you worried about losing the mount from the Kentucky Derby to the Preakness to the Belmont?
I was worried probably about it more before the Triple Crown because, you know, I actually had gotten suspended, and I misriding him in the Santa Anita Derby, and Lafitte rode him, and he won on him by, you know, like, you know, easy. But they put me right back on him for the Hollywood Derby, which, you know, was back then a dirt race that came up, you know, and so I rode him and won on him, so I knew I was right, you know. Mr. Wolfson and Mrs. Wolfson were great in that way. They gave me a lot of confidence that they had confidence in me. But, you know, like, yeah, when you're young and, you know, you're always, you know, and you know these other guys are good and more experienced, particularly in the big races, you know.
Yeah.
I always was a little concerned beforehand, but, you know, not that. I mean, it's like, yeah, I was, when I got to the Derby, I was just glad to, you know, be there, have a shot to ride a horse that had a chance, you know. And then once we won, I'll tell you a funny story. Cause so we won the Derby, and we were at the reception that night, with the Wolfsons, and Mr. Wilson was standing there. My little brother, Kerry, was standing there. He was 9 years old at the time. And you know, he'd always kind of hang around Mr. Wilson, you know, and look out, you know, with big eye listening to him, you know, and Mr. Wilson always pat him on the head and give him a few bucks, you know, here and there.
Nice.
And he said, "We sure are proud of your brother, Kerry, you know, he really rode a great race for us today." And Kerry looked up at him, he said, "Mr. Wilson, anybody could have won on your horse today."
Thanks, Kerry.
Thanks a lot, bro.
You're not going to be my agent.
But anyway, now the Wilson's always, you know, that was a great thing. Yeah, you know, it's
really less, loyal.
Yeah, very loyal. Very, you know, Mr. Wilson particularly. You know, I think he knew how to inspire people and get people, you know, motivated. And
right, because the horse is going to feel that confidence. So I always know whether it's the trainer or the owner, right, has confidence in me, like riding for you.
Yeah, right.
It's just so much easier to go out there and give your best shot. And if it's not the horse's day, you're not going to be blamed for
it. Exactly. So, I went into the Derby, you know, obviously full of hope, and, you know, I wasn't worried about anything. But, and really the Preakness the same, you know, it's like, you know, I knew because, you know, it wasn't like, you know, if Aladar beat me, wasn't like, you know, nobody in the world was expecting.
Wrong.
You know, he was a good horse. He was a great horse, you know.
He was the favorite in each stage.
He was a favorite in the Derby. He wasn't, we were the favorite in the Preakness and the favorite in the Belmont, you know, but probably the favorite in the Preakness because it was a short, you know, they probably, most people figured Aladar needed further, not shorter, you know, because, you know, he obviously
always
was kind of a
one
run horse, you know, and, anyway, he kept getting closer every time. He's like, they did like a 109 workout with him, right before the Preakness.
And
so we knew what they were. We're coming.
He'd be rolling.
We're gonna be getting up there chasing you sooner than we were last time. Yeah. You know, so, and they did, and you know, but the Preakness, I was very confident. You know, I always felt like we had him, and you know, I was waiting for him, and when we hooked up and picked up like we had again in the hopeful, you know, I knew, I just thought, you know, I got you, you know, I knew, you know, I just knew we had enough. In the Belmont, it was a little different because, you know, again, it's a mile and a half, first time any of these horses have gone that far. And when we got to the quarter pole, I knew we were going to have to dig deep because Aladar was right there, you know, and I could feel a little bit of fatigue in my horse, but, and that's when I hit him left-handed for the first time I'd ever hit him left-handed. And, you know, he just found that enough to get his head back in front and hold him off to the line.
Affirmed under a left-hand whip. Aladar on the outside driving. Affirmed at Aladar, heads apart. Affirmed's got a nose in front as he come onto the wire.
But, you know, I always knew I could count on Affirm. You know, it's like, you know, it's kind of like,
you establish that trust between the bank, horse and rider.
Like you can go to the bank on, you know, a horse like him because, you know, you just know the only way he's not going to give it to you is if he hadn't got it. So, you know, the Belmont, I will say, at the end of that race that he had given literally everything he had because you can see in the picture in the winning circle, I mean, they got the carnations over his head and he's like, his head's like,
it's drooping. I'm exhausted.
Like, yeah. He had definitely, you know, laid it all out on the line that day.
What was that feeling crossing the wire first in the Belmont?
Well, you know, it was amazing simply because I knew I couldn't make any mistakes, and luckily I didn't. And I knew that the horse had to give me everything, and luckily he did. And yeah, we won by that much.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it was kind of like the perfect race.
Yeah. And you won the English Filly's Triple Crown as well.
I did, on a really great filly. You know, I would consider her the equivalent of a firm, the female equivalent. You know, she was just kind of that all around, you know, she could run at any distance. She, you know, she was game. She wanted to win. She, she beat colts and in the ledger and ran against colts a couple other times. She should have really been undefeated, really, mm-hmm. to be quite honest. She got beaten the King George, and that was on rock hard ground. You know, as time went on, we realized, you know, that I won the guineas on her on firm ground, and just got up the last few strides. But part of it was because she was hating the firm ground.
Mm.
You know, she'd never really run on it that much before, so
yeah.
Didn't know. But then at that time I was just thinking maybe the distance is too short. But what it really was the ground was too firm. And then in the King George, it was the middle. You know, it's the middle of summer. I mean, the ground was probably like the highway. You know, it's that hard. So, you know, and not only that, a couple things that, you know, the horse. I was just coming up to the head of the stretch, and I just got lapped on the horse that had been in front, and I was, you know, obviously going to wait another furlong or so and then kick. Well, at the head of the stretch, there's like almost 3 furlongs out.
Yeah.
This horse bolted to the outside fence, which
carried
I was already
you.
Lapping. So then I had to kick on sooner.
Mm-hmm.
I got to the front, and yeah, and then of course that last part up the hill.
She's getting tired.
Just hating the ground. It kind of like started climbing and like, you know,
And
this horse just came and beat me half a length. And then in the other time she got beat was in the bottomless ground, you know, in a older horse that had won the St. Ledger,
mm-hmm.
out, you know, just kind of out plowed through the ground better than she did. But, you know, she was really a special filly. And actually, the neat thing was I got to end up riding a filly out of her that I won a grade one on called Rose Finch, which was cool. So, you know, like
I like riding family horses.
Yeah, like, you know, especially when they, you know, turn out to be
like
somewhat
sibling.
Somewhat like their mom, you know, or.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you've ridden a sire, that you know, like there's kind of you realize that horse has passed on
the traits,
some of the traits and genetics and whatever talent. But she was a great filly. So yeah, that was and it hadn't been done since over
mm-hmm.
there. I mean, obviously since there's been 2 Triple Crown winners here since Firm did it, but over the actually she was the last filly to do it in '85. And I think the last horse to do it was Nijinsky
mm-hmm.
in 1967, something
okay.
like that. So that hadn't been done. A horse hadn't won the Triple Crown since '67 in
wow.
England.
And having won the U.S. Triple Crown and the English Triple Crown shows your consistency and ability to thrive under pressure. And I like the quote that champions interpret pressure as excitement. How did you do that?
I just tried not to make anything bigger than it had to be, you know, like
mm-hmm.
I went into the Derby thinking this is just another race,
mm-hmm.
which it really is. You know, I don't want to try to overthink it or over, you know, I tried to play down, you know, the enormity of what it really is. And that's kind of how I went through, you know, tried to downplay stuff, you know, make it not get overwhelming. And, in all, that's pretty much it. Just not, you know, not make something bigger than it really needs to be.
Mm-hmm. And you didn't become your typical teenage success star. You remained humble. I've watched a lot of your interviews through the Triple Crown at 18.
I'm just a regular guy. I just, I don't like to be treated any different.
And your reputation is great. How did you stay grounded with early success?
You know, my parents were great. You know, I think I think a lot of all my success, you know, came from my family, my parents, particularly my dad. But my mom too. You know, she gave me a lot of my competitiveness and, you know, my athleticism, because she was a really great athlete. She was really good at anything she did. Yeah, they kept my feet on the ground. Just kind of, you know, they, you know, my dad constantly remembered, you know, don't forget the road up, you know, the people you pass on the way up, you know, you're going to pass them on the way down too. So be nice to them.
That's good advice from dad.
So anyway.
You've told me before, the harder you worked, the luckier you got. Mm-hmm. I'm sure people around you just talked about having luck, but clearly you were dedicated, skipping out on hanging out with friends and working out in your hay bale. And
I think that's what's really worked for, you know, as you say, staying focused and, you know, realizing that nothing's easy that's, you know, worth doing. You know, it's, you have to put in the effort. And I was willing to, you know, I was willing to do it, you know, and then some, if I could, you know, just whatever. I wanted to be good and then be better.
Mm-hmm.
Good. So.
Yeah.
But, and, you know, of course, having been around a lot of successful people, whether they're sports stars or business people or whatever, I kind of find that that happens a lot with those kind of people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that they're willing to go the extra mile, do what it takes to kind of get there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, like you said, then you kind of got to also realize, too, that at the same time, keep it in perspective that, you know, there's world wars going on or people starving in, you know, Africa or whatever. And, you know, we're riding horses, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's important to us, but it's not in the grand scheme of things, you know. So if you get beat in the race that you maybe should have even won, you know.
Yeah.
It's not going to change, you know.
That's really good perspective. It's very easy to get jockey tunnel vision.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, and I try to, you know, kind of be real.
Mm-hmm. I read your book, The Kid, and it talked about your agent, Lenny Goodman.
Mm-hmm.
Something that stuck out to me was talked about he wouldn't spin trainers at the draw to ride a better horse.
Right.
Yet he focused on the long-term loyalty, building up that trust and relationships. It's definitely not the common approach to racing. And being his jockey and being in high demand and knowing he was turning down sometimes what would be the winner in the race, was that ever hard for you? Were you guys on the same mindset?
No, I mean, I left him do his job and I did mine. I told him what I thought were the better horses, you know, when I was riding them, and he'd say, you know, we got a shot to ride this or that, you know, what do you think? And I'd tell him what I think. And sometimes he would still not do what I told him because he thought it was more important to take care of that trainer who had the what I didn't think was the best horse. Sometimes I'd still win on them, you know.
I bet.
Not because they were the best, you know.
But you got the
best. Maybe I got it wrong, you know. I probably got it wrong. But, you know, it's I never minded that because, again, that was kind of down to my dad's, you know, kind of my dad's teachings of, you know, treat people the way you want to be treated. And, you know, spending people at the last second was not, you know, what I wanted to do, you know, either. Like you said, it was more important for me to keep the guys that were giving me really good mounts day in, mm-hmm. day out than, you know, for one particular race or whatever. So, yeah, I never minded that. The only time is I could have actually ridden Spectacular Bid.
Oh.
And for some reason, he chose
to. Well, Lenny.
Lenny messed that one up. Anyway, God forgive you, Lenny.
That's right. What was it like to win the Sports Illustrated Sportsman of the Year over Muhammad Ali and Reggie Jackson?
Well, you know, I mean, at the time, I was winning so many awards, I didn't know what, you know, and at first.
What the significance was.
I mean, yeah, to be quite honest, I wouldn't.
Who's Muhammad Ali?
Well, I mean, no, I knew that. I knew who that was, but I didn't, like, Sports Illustrated Sportsman of the Year, I didn't know that was that big of a deal or what it really was at the time, probably at first, you know, anyway. But, you know, I thought, oh, this is cool. Muhammad Ali, you know, and Reggie Jackson, because Reggie was up there playing for the Yankees and winning, mm-hmm. you know, winning, hitting home runs and being a star on, you know, we'd see him. He was in the papers almost as much as I was.
Mm-hmm.
So, but anyway, the funny story, about years later, I was up in Baltimore at a card signing thing. And I ran into, you know, it was a huge place. And, you know, there was football, basketball, all kinds of stuff. They had, you know, World Series trophies and, you know, every kind of, you know, memorabilia thing that you could ever have. And when I got done signing my card, so that I was signing, I was walking around, looking around, and I saw Reggie Jackson. So I'd never met the guy, and I thought, well, I'm going to go say hi to this, you know, say hi. And so I said, you know, Mr. Jackson, how you doing? And he said, oh, how you doing? I said, I'm Steve Cawthon. I said, I used to be in New York when you were, you know, hitting all the home runs for the Yanks. And, you know, he was real nice, and we were just chatting kind of real friendly-like, and then all of a sudden, you know, he said, a basketball player came by, and he said, you know, come over here. I want you to meet this kid, this guy, you know, and because I wasn't kidding, but mm-hmm. he said, this is Steve Cawthon. And he said, you know, I had two chances to be Sports Illustrated Sportsman of the Year. He said, one time I got beat by a horse, Secretariat, and the other time this little punk beat me. So he said, oh, I'm not sure if I like racing. But anyway, it was just a funny thing that happened, you know. And funny that he even remembered it back then, that, you know, 30-something years later. But anyway, it was cool. I mean, you know, for obviously I think I'm the only jockey that's ever won that. So
wow. Yeah, I believe that's right.
Doesn't really happen. You know, like you said, racing doesn't very often get its due, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Always recognized, and it's probably less recognized now than it was back then, you know, but so it was cool, it was fun. And you know, I had since met Muhammad Ali, and you know, just, you know, you realize how big these guys really are, you know, how well known they are worldwide. And you know, he was inspirational in many ways, you know. I think he inspired a lot of people, young guys that, you know, are looking for what to do, and you know, getting to boxing or whatever, and just trying to kind of, you know, in his way, guide people the right direction.
Mm-hmm. To me, a true sports hero is someone who has gone through a major setback, had the press and the fans in their face,
mm-hmm.
Had your backers, you know, trainers, people you were winning for before, turn their back on you.
Mm-hmm.
You went through a major drought. It's really inspired me in my career. Can you talk about that?
Sure, sure. Yeah, I mean, I, you know, in 1978, literally a month and a half or so after I won the Triple Crown, I had a bad fall up in Saratoga where I injured my knee. I had a little chip, you know, a little fracture under my kneecap, but it caused a lot of pain and a lot of headaches for me, because you know, you can't ride as a jockey, you know, your knee
is pretty important.
I mean, you know, so I was out, and I missed riding affirmed in the Traverse Stakes for start.
Mm.
And, you know, so I was trying to do everything I could to get back, and probably rushed it, you know, because I healed so quick, you know, that first time.
Yeah, the first time. That was a lot of broken bones. This is just a little chip.
Yeah. So, but it obviously, so I, you know, I did obviously everything that I was supposed to do, but I still probably pushed myself to get back quicker than I should have. And because I wanted to ride a firm, you know, and he was going to run against, you know, Seattle Slew in the Marlboro. And then, you know, he had obviously, you know, we wanted to be a horse of the year again. Or horse of the year for the first time. He was 2-year-old champion as a 2-year-old, then he was horse of the year 3 and 4. I rushed myself to try to get back to ride him, and you know, all of a sudden, you know, nobody, it was kind of strange, because Laz, I was thinking, you know, he'll be dying for me to get back up, you know. Well, he wasn't right, you know, quite as hungry to get me back as I thought he should be, but anyway, So anyway, that was, I got off to a slow start. This was still in New York. And then we went to California. Well, California, I was, New York was, you know, had been my base. Mm-hmm. California, I was just out there the winter before. And I'd done great the winter before. I won, you know, 85, 90 races. And, you know, I was leading rider most of the meet.
Mm-hmm.
And Pinkai just came and beat me at the end, you know, by three or four races. But, you know, I went out this time and like, I was, you would have thought I had, you know, the plague, you know? I mean, mm-hmm. I was riding for Laz, you know, what we had, but, you know, the horses just kind of weren't really in great form yet, you know, mm-hmm. whatever, you know, it's
right. It's year round sport.
It's right. Nothing was quite clicking. You know, they're all running okay. They just weren't quite clicking. And literally, I couldn't get a good mount from anybody else. I mean, like, I was riding 40, 50 to one shots for, you know, all the other trainers that would even bother to give me a mount, you know? So, I mean, like, and then you know, you lose your confidence. I mean, I don't care who you are and how great you've been, you know, done or been, you know, it's easy enough to start, you know, scratching your head, like, and what am I doing? Mm-hmm. I don't know, right. You know? And I'm not sure that I was really doing anything that much wrong, just, you know, but when you lose your confidence, when you do actually have the halfway decent mount, you probably, you know, you do maybe move a little bit quicker, you know, or not as quick as you would normally do.
Not quite as cool.
You just don't, you're not as, you know, as geared into everything as you. And, it, you know, so I went to 110 races without a winner, which is a long, even though, you know, it's probably all happened over 3.5 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because I was riding, you know, still riding 7 or 8 races a day.
And the press was taking advantage. Well,
and the press were killing me. And, you know,
like headlines coming out about this pretty often, right? They're just putting out headlines about stats.
It was the biggest thing, you know. I mean, like I said, well, that's what sells papers, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, something that's, you know, we built him up on the way up. Now we're going to, I mean, like, mm-hmm. felt like they were literally, you know, like sticking knives in me coming down, you know, like,
yeah.
And, you know, but what was really hurtful is, you know, guys that I'd, you know, ridden for, won, you know, like I won the Triple Crown. It's like, you know, that you just really, you really didn't feel like you had their confidence or that they were really trying to, you know, that they were worrying about you too much, you know, like, you know, mm-hmm. Oh, maybe.
Yeah.
Is there any way we can not use them? And, yeah, but anyway, it worked through it, and I finally, you know, ended up winning a race after 110 races on Father Duffy, which was one of Aaron Jones's horses, and that's when Mr. Sangster, came and offered me the job to go to Europe, because he realized he actually asked me to come ride Hawaiian Sound in the Derby, the Epsom Derby, but it was coincided with the Belmont Stakes, okay. And that's why I didn't go, because I didn't want to take a chance on getting jet lagged or anything. But at this time, it was like, hey, I thought, you know, what have I got to lose? And then the other point that he made when we were having dinner one night was, you know, Steve, you're probably going to end up needing to come to Europe in the end anyway because of your weight.
Mm-hmm.
And when I really sat down and thought about it, I realized he was right. You know, it's like, you know, my weight's, you know, I can still do what, you know, one.
Whatever. Yeah. What did you have to ride at back then? It was even lighter.
I could ride at whatever back then.
But what were the general weights? But,
you know, like, I mean, a 100, guy.
100, 110.
No, I mean, a guy that could still ride at 115 could do okay.
Okay.
But you couldn't really do much more than that. If you couldn't mm-hmm. ride at 115 every day, all day long, you were going to struggle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I wasn't there yet, but I.
But you're growing.
Where I was heading, you know, mm-hmm. and I kept growing until I was 21.
How tall did you end up being?
I am 5'5".
Okay, I'm 5'4".
And I was 5'1" when I started.
Right.
At 16.
It's a growth spurt, yeah.
So, anyway, I realized he was right, and that's, you know, what in the end made me say, you know, what the heck, and you know, it was a great decision for me because I rode for 17 years. If I'd have stayed here, I doubt I would have been able to ride more than 7 or 6 or 7 or 8, you know,
because mm-hmm.
I would have, you know, without killing myself, because I've literally, you know, I ended up not being able to ride. Over there at the end, I could ride at 120,
mm-hmm.
but I didn't even have to do that most of the time. It was just, you know, during the big meets. Mm-hmm. So most of the time, all I had, I was doing 123, 126. You know? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it kept me going a lot longer than I would have been able to do it here, I think.
Yeah. What is it about your riding style or your connection to a horse that you think set you apart from other jockeys?
You know, I had a connection with my hands, you know. I had good hands. And, you know, like you said, I think I thought like a horse. You know, I was trying to get a horse to want to do what I wanted him to do most of the time. You know, every once in a while I get pissed off at one. But, you know.
They teach us patience.
Yeah. But mainly I was, you know, trying to encourage horses to, you know, want to do what I wanted them to do. And, I don't know. You know, I think one of my benefits, you know, I did have a good, you know, idea of time, mm-hmm. how fast horses were going. So I think that was a big factor in my success. But, you know, my getting along with horses and getting horses to run for me, and there's some guys that horses run for and some guys that horses don't run for, mm-hmm. or as well, you know, not consistently. You know, most horses ran for me, a few types that, you know, didn't get along with as well, but, you know, I could mm-hmm. handle most kind. But you know, there's different guys that, you know, horses run for and that some don't. Horses run for you, horses break well for you, you know. There's certain things that you do, you know, that I don't, you know,
it's hard to put a finger on what.
Yeah, right. I mean, yeah. You do it. I mean, I'm sure, you know, you know, getting horses out of the gate, you know, is important, but it's, you know,
not something I really try to do.
Everybody does it differently. You know, maybe it's because you're relaxed. You know, I don't, mm-hmm. more relaxed than some people. I don't know what it is. I just know that, you know, horses break great for you, and, you know, they're usually, that gives them a chance to be in a mm-hmm. good position early, and that's important. For me, you know, you do different things that, you know, work for you, and it's different for everybody. Like you said, you try to do stuff that you see works for other people, mm-hmm. and some of it works for you and some doesn't, and you just, you know, everybody's kind of got their own little things that work and they use.
Mm-hmm. I can tell you really love horses. I think some jockeys are great athletes and they approach it more like a sport. Others seem to really be horsemen, mm-hmm. love the horse. There's several quotes in the Kentucky Derby Racing Museum.
Yeah.
And I like yours that says, to be involved with a great racehorse is a special blessing. And that really stood out to me. What is that like?
Well, you know, it's not only it was obviously a horse like affirmed. It was great, but it was also the team, you know, the whole thing, you know, it's like, mm-hmm. It's always a team, you know?
Yeah. Without the preparation of the horse.
People, you know, I don't care what you do, but nobody does anything by themselves, you know? They mm-hmm. don't get there by themselves. Mm-hmm. They don't stay there by themselves. You know, you got to have people and other, you know, individuals. Like when I think of the well-oiled machine that was the Affirm team back in the day, you know, we had a great trainer. We had some great owners that, you know, allowed us all to feel comfortable about what we, you know.
Mm-hmm. Give you really that backing and loyalty.
The backing, the loyalty, and the free rein to do what we thought was right. You know, we had great people working in the stable. Mm-hmm. Toto, the kid, I think he might still be galloping horses somewhere, mm-hmm. Was just a great, you know, exercise rider. He rode him more than I, you know, I'd only ride the odd work, bit of work. He ended up, you know, because it was work, you know, he knew the horse and he knew what to do. He did most of the, you know, the work, except, you know, maybe if Laz wanted something specific to do, you know, to be done that he knew, you know, be better for me to try to do. His Juan is, you know, groom, mm-hmm. that like literally slept in the barn, you know, barn with him and in the stall if he had to. Mm-hmm. You know, it takes a great team to, you know, accomplish great things. And we had a great team with a great horse. You know, the bottom line is you got to have the great horse to start with. But if you got a great team surrounding them, then you can do, you know, some amazing things. And when I look at, you know, the secretariat team or, you know, this even the Seattle Slough team, and you know, they all had great, you know, great teams. And
it's not all that
cool to be involved with, because it's you know, even though you're just a part of it, you know, it's everybody has to play their part and do to it to perfection, really, to make it all work, you know, like it's like it does when you win the Triple Crown.
Yeah. And I think it's more meaningful when you are connected to all the people.
Yeah, that's when stuff
you realize it's beyond yourself.
If you win stuff by yourself, it's kind of, you know, gets lonely.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You got to share stuff, you know, and it makes it a lot more fun.
Yeah. Great athletes talk about getting into a flow state. Mm-hmm. I believe getting into a flow state with a racehorse takes that to another level. Your riding reminds me very much of that. Can you describe what that feels like?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you're really in tune, you know, when you're really fit and you're, you know, in the zone, as you say, you know, everything happens slower. You know, it's like split second things, you know, your mind has enough time to casually make a decision, like you need to go inside or, you know, make a decision about what to do in a race. And, yeah, it's when you're kind of in the zone, it's really cool. And you know, you're in the zone with the motion of the horse. And, the best thing you can ever do to, you know, with a horse is not get in his way. Mm-hmm. Not, you know, a lot of, you know, there's whipping and all this stuff. It looks good, but it's, you know, it never, you know.
It's the balance point, really.
Balance and keeping in rhythm and keeping, you know, as long as the horse is running, you know, I mean, some horses, you got to wake them up, get them going. But once if a horse is running for you, you know, the biggest thing you can do is not get in his way, not get him unbalanced. And, you know, it's a cool thing. It's a poetry in motion, really. It's, you know, it's a wonderful thing to, and that's one of the things that captures people's imagination is when they see all the colors and the beauty and the balance and the competition, you know, the horses competing, you know. I mean, I think horse people really get a lot out of watching what they want to be come out on a horse, you know, like a horse really fighting out a finish. Yeah. And they, you know, it's
and a great horse.
It's all the things that you wish you were. You know?
Yeah, when a horse knows that it's won or lost, people are always shocked when I tell them that.
Yeah. So, you know, champions are champions. You know, it's great to see something special. And, you know, that horses like Affirmed or, you know, just, you know, something you want to, you know, you never get enough of them. You know, and you know, he was a great personality as well. He's a really intelligent horse that, you know, he was just fun to be around, you know.
Yeah.
Because you could just see that he knew what was going on. You know, like, you know, he really knows what that we're all sitting here admiring him. Yeah, you know? And he likes it.
Yeah, I find that too. Some horses are photogenic. They love the camera.
Yep.
Yeah, they have great personalities.
So,
and when you moved to Europe, they said your riding style was very unique. You were still and low. European riders have more of they move a lot more in the saddle. And you were also confident to put a horse on the lead, and they more often like to tuck in and come off the pace. How, being a newcomer there, did you stick with your gut and just go with what you knew was right?
Because I didn't know what else, you know. I mean, again, you know, I was lucky. You know, I was with a guy, Barry Hills, who I first went to ride for, you know, who I could, you know, immediately kind of had faith in me. And I knew how he wanted his horses ridden generally, but, you know, he was open to letting me, you know, do what I thought was right. And, you know, obviously right off the bat, I won the guineas for him on a long shot. And I won a couple races from the front. And Hawaiian Sound, the horse that I originally went, really kind of was brought over to ride, was kind of a front-running horse. So,
you let the horse
once I realized, you know, you could ride that way, you know, you just had to pace the horse, you know, allowing for uphill finishes, you know, the tracks are different, but generally, you know, if you get a horse relaxed and you know how fast you're going, you know how fast a horse can run in a race, you know, you got to just have enough to, you know, out finish him up the hill, you know, from the front or wherever you're at. You know, if you're coming from behind, you got to have more than that because you got to pass them and, you know, make up that ground and then still get past them. So, I didn't mind. I mean, I liked riding from, you know, front end, behind. That wasn't so much, but it's all kind of just judging pace and kind of knowing where you're at and, you know, how far you got to go and how much horse you got left.
Mm-hmm. After retiring from riding, you've stayed involved in horse racing and the whole thoroughbreds lifestyle. You breed your own. You're the first one on their back to train them under saddle, right?
I haven't done that for a while. About 4 years ago was my last ones that I broke.
Uh-huh.
And that all went well. I broke them, and that was all fine. And then I came out here to get on, and I jumped on one of them that was with Kellen Gordon. It dumped me, and I basically got a compressed fracture in my back, you know, from just, you know, falling off and landing on my butt.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, this probably isn't worth it anymore because, you know, I'm getting too old.
Uh-huh.
I'm not going to heal as much as quick as I used to. So I've kind of given up on, you know, riding. You know, I mean, I could jump on a horse and ride, but mm-hmm. trying to break young horses is, you know, probably not really mm-hmm. too smart for a guy that's as old as me.
Yeah.
The bones ain't healing as quick as they used to.
Yeah, I'm sure. But I think it's great that you're still so involved. And
yeah, I like it. I mean, I love being involved with, like, Dixie Anna, you know, where I, you know, help with their racing stable. And, you know, I get to see the jockeys and talk to, you know, Red Ortiz and, you know, Luis Saez and these guys that, you know,
mm-hmm.
basically they're doing what I did, you know, and kind mm-hmm. of, you know, relating it to now. And, you know, it's kind of what I know. It's like kind of makes me feel like I'm a part of it again, you know, when you retire, you know, you're kind of, you're on the outside again, you know,
mm-hmm.
it's like you're not in the middle of it all, you know?
Right.
Unless you do something, you know, once I started, I never really quite realized that until I started doing it again and how much I, you know, enjoy mm-hmm. kind of still playing the game and being involved and knowing, you know, how everybody thinks and what's going on, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you've been a great mentor to me, so we appreciate.
Thank you, yeah.
Yeah, great. Having someone who's seen it all.
Well. Like you said, happy to, you know, like you said, that's all I got to do is try to pass on what little stuff I do know. So
yeah, little stuff.
Yeah.
If you could go back and talk to your younger self, what would you have told yourself?
You know, I think things kind of happen like they're supposed to, you know, it's like, I don't know. I mean, I think you have bad, you know, things are put in your way to teach you stuff and.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as it turned out, my bad streak probably was a blessing, you know, in disguise. I didn't
opened
see it that way
door.
At the time. Yeah, it's, you know, a door shuts, a window opens, you know. It's
mm-hmm.
And, that, you know, I tried to, you know, see it that way as best I could. But, you know, it's hard to see it till it you know, till you go through it and live it. And then, you know, like even, like you said, the things that kind of I felt like were hurting me from the way people acted, it just made me understand people, you know?
Yeah.
And
so, I also think it's made you incredibly loyal.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I think you're right, because, you know, like you say, it didn't feel good, and I don't think it's a great way to treat people, but, you know, mm-hmm. I think I understand it because it's business, you know?
It's like,
I mean, I understood even why it happened, you know, in certain ways. It's, you know, those kind of stories sell papers. That's why the guy's right. I mean, you know, the guy maybe didn't want to be doing it, but
mm-hmm.
you know, he did it because that's how he made his money. But it still hurts at the time because, you know that you've gone out of your way to help these guys, you know, when they were asking you for help.
Mm-hmm.
They needed a story or whatever. And, you know, so, you know, but, you know, it's all those things I think are, you know, like you said, they happened the way they were meant to happen, you know.
Right. Without adversity, we won't grow.
Yeah.
We never want it.
No, that's true.
Yeah.
That's true. It's scary to grow.
Yes, it is.
So
I'll close with one final question.
Yeah.
What advice would you give to someone just starting their career?
You know, I'm not talking about jockeyship or anything in, you know, life. I think, you know, just the biggest thing is to surround yourself with good people, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's you know, it's not always easy to do, but, you know, you got to try to find the, you know, good people, because, you know, good people will help you without expecting something in return, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's, you know, I think good people want to pass on what their knowledge is, you know, as you say, you know, it's like, you realize how blessed you've been. You want to share, you know, your blessings with somebody else who mm-hmm. has decided to do something that you understand, and
yeah.
try to help them, you know. But yeah, it's I was blessed, you know. I was I realize this now, you know. I mean, as I was going through life, you know, I thought it was all me, but but I realized how lucky I was. The people that kind of, you know, were in my path, you know, from my family, you know, from to the, you know, early days living with Chuck Taliaferro and his wife, you know, having that blessing of being in New York, you know, but having a family atmosphere around
yeah.
me instead of
just yeah. living in an apartment by yourself.
Whatever, yeah.
Yeah.
And just
lonely.
Things that, yeah, yeah, where I could have gotten a lot more trouble pretty easy.
Yeah. Being a jockey is a lonely path.
Yeah. It is. It's, you know, and yeah, it's, so yeah, I mean, so I just think, you know, and I, having good parents, they tried to put me in the path of good people, and, you know, they did. And then I, luckily along the way, started realizing this is the way to go.
Mm-hmm.
Stick with the good people.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you for sharing that with us today.
Yeah, my pleasure. Good talking to you.
You too.
And now for a moment from our next episode, airing January 30th with Patty Cooksey.
And I know you were the second female in history to ride in the Kentucky Derby. Can you describe a bit what that experience was like?
It was like a sound barrier. The people and the audience screaming so loud that you hit this like sound barrier. It felt like that's the wall.
Boundless is a podcast that explores the stories of individuals who have accomplished the seemingly impossible by breaking molds and redefining success through unique challenges, pivotal moments, and unbreakable determination.